From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Fred Goodman is my guest this week. He is a chronicler of the music industry, and his books include The Mansion on the Hill, Dylan, Young, Geffen, Springsteen, and the Head-On Collision of Rock and Commerce, and Fortune's Fool, Edgar Bronfman Jr., Warner Music, and an Industry in Crisis. His new book is about the controversial manager of some of rock's royalty, and it's called Alan Klein, the man who bailed out the Beatles, made the Stones, and transformed rock and roll. Fred Goodman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Pleasure.
Congratulations on your book. You do a fine job of taking some complicated financial talk and making it interesting and easy to understand.
Well, thank you. It's an interesting business to me, and Klein was a fascinating character.
Well, a lot of people love to say, you know, that Yoko Ono broke up the Beatles, but maybe Alan Klein broke up the Beatles.
Well, you know, when I grew up as a Beatles and Rolling Stones fan, you know, Alan Klein was a name you heard sometimes, and never anything good.
Yeah, right.
You know, he was, you know, reputedly had a role in breaking up the Beatles, and was the guy who, you know, was supposed to have robbed the Rolling Stones, and this is basically what you heard, and still hear today. But of course, my background is that I'm a business reporter who's covered the music business for Rolling Stone and Billboard and other publications, and I thought the situation was probably more complicated, and when I got the chance to write about him, I found that it was.
Very, very much so. Hey, did you ever get a chance to actually meet him?
You know, once in passing, when he was doing one of his Sam Cooke projects, you know, he invited us into his office and, you know, sort of gave you the presence of Alan Klein blessing this project.
What made you decide to write about him?
Well, it's very interesting. After I had done the book on Edgar Bronfman, I was approached by Alan Klein's son, Jody Klein, who still runs ABCO, the company that Alan started. And he said to me, his father had died about 2 or 3 years earlier, and he said to me, look, you know, a lot was written about my dad. Some of it was true, and some of it wasn't true. He said, you know, I read your book. I think you know something about how the business operates. You know, we would like to, if you're interested, give you the opportunity to have access to all our papers and all our corporate records. And, you know, you make up your own mind and, you know, let the chips fall where they may. We just want somebody, you know, who has a working knowledge of the industry to say what they think was true or not about them. So, you know, for me, this was kind of like, so you're basically offering me the chance to go through the Beatles contracts and all the Rolling Stones contracts and litigation and to read the correspondence and kind of get an idea of what was said in the room when the door was closed, huh? And to me, that was kind of like the offer I couldn't refuse.
Right, right. So did you, as you were looking in, you know, in the room with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, what did you find that was, you know, surprising or incredible?
Well, you know, first of all, there's a lot. I mean, I had no appreciation of who Klein was, first of all, as a person. You know, I had no inkling that he had had this background where he'd been raised in an orphanage in Newark, and that he would bring to his life this sort of perspective of someone who always felt like an outsider, who felt that they had been rejected and would go to great lengths to, you know, ingratiate themselves and to prove themselves, you know. So at Klein, it's interesting, you know, he made a lot of money, but he was not a guy who was in it to make a mountain of money, you know, that really wasn't his god. He wanted control over his life and he wanted influence and, you know, he wanted to be able to hold people close, which he hadn't been able to do as a child or growing up. And that part of it was all unknown to me, but also the man's sort of sophistication and to watch his trajectory, you know, he was an accountant by training. And you could see as he worked each deal how one would lead to another, to another, to another, until he was making deals for the Rolling Stones and Beatles that, you know, really no one else could make or had made. So it was very interesting to see both his development and the development of the business.
So you became Klein's psychiatrist as you were investigating all this.
Well, you know, it's really fascinating. I mean, he left behind, you know, many hours of taped conversation, which have never been published, and that was sort of him telling his story of his life, which was really kind of, you know, invaluable to me and gave me a resource that no one else had. But along with that, you know, you have to sift through. It was very interesting, you know, when I met his son, Jody Klein. I said, okay, you know, I'll do it after we talked about it. And he agreed that they would have no editorial control over the project at all. So we were going to go forward. And I said, all right, let me see what you have. And he took me to a warehouse in New Jersey and brought out skids full of documents. I mean, I was suddenly like, oh, man, what did I just get into? You know, because it literally, I mean, just the Rolling Stones, there's 18 years of lawsuits back and forth.
Right. I mean, that's kind of like how they communicated. They had
that was how it is. In fact, you know, towards the end, there's some very funny stuff where Keith Richards is talking about how silly it's gotten, you know. He says, we've been in court 18 years, and everybody comes in and says hello just like you're going to the office. You know? So, and in fact, there was one very funny bit where they were involved in litigation. The Stones were complaining that Klein was paying them publishing royalties too slowly and that they needed the court to take it over. And when they got into court, Klein's lawyer asked Prince Rupert Lowenstein, who had succeeded him as the Stones' financial manager, he said, is it true that, you know, you make $500 bets with Klein over when you're going to get paid? And he pauses and he goes, no, it's 1,000. And at which point the judge decided this was not a serious matter if the two managers were betting when it was going to happen. So as you can see, it does get out of hand. At one point, I think Klein said he was suing the Stones because Mick Jagger made a face at one of his daughters. I mean, the whole thing just gets kind of nuts. But that overshadows the fact that early on in the relationship, it was an important relationship for the Stones and for Klein. He got them a lot of money. At a time when the Beatles were splitting a penny four ways on a single, Klein got them $2.4 million guaranteed from their record company, which was an unheard of amount of money, and was instrumental in helping them establish themselves as a premier act in the United States.
Well, yeah, I guess it's well known now that Brian Epstein, the Beatles' original manager, mm-hmm. who brought them to fame, didn't know anything about business and made some really, really, really bad business deals.
You know, he was a very gentlemanly guy. Look, Brian Epstein was, you know, in some ways a magnificent manager, and he was, you know, a brilliant impresario. You know, I mean, without Brian Epstein, you know, the world would not have met the Beatles, and he certainly, you know, opened up the door through which many, many, many people later came. You know, so this alone, you know, gives him, you know, I think a vaunted place in the history of the music. Now, that said, he was not, you're right, a sophisticated businessman, and he also was a very gentlemanly sort of businessman. In other words, he would not renegotiate deals. He accepted deals that were substandard. You know, he made some bad moves financially, and you know, Paul McCartney, who, of course, you know, was always grateful and talked about how much Brian Epstein did for the Beatles, you know, he did at one point say, look, you know, he took financial advice from his father, and his father ran a furniture store in Liverpool. You know, the notion being that, you know, he did what he could, but he really had no sense of what it would take to run a worldwide music industry empire.
And after his death, Alan Klein, you know, was right there waiting to step in. And I want to ask you about this. It's not really in your book. You talk about this gentlemanly aspect of Brian Epstein, who was, mm-hmm. of course, Jewish, and Klein was Jewish. But
right. Is
there kind of an anti-Semitism thing about Klein? I mean, he's more Jewish than Brian Epstein.
Well, look, you know, he in England, he's not Jewish. And I had spoken with a business manager over there named Lawrence Meyer, who is also an English Jew who had worked with Klein, you know, and he talked about, you know, he said, look, there was a classism, there was an air of anti-Semitism, you know, at the record companies. He said, and the English Jew was bad, but the New York Jew was worse, you know. And Klein was very, very abrasive. You know, he went out of his way to be insulting to people in negotiations. It was part of his negotiating tactic to put somebody off their game. And he would really get in there, you know. Of course, you'd go into the English office and they'd offer you tea and he'd say, we don't drink tea. You know, I mean, he would literally, you know, just stop them and, you know, he would say what he wanted and, you know, take control of meetings. And there's a famous story that Ray Davies, the Kinks, were represented by Klein in some of their negotiations. You know, and he tells a story that Klein was so abrasive in one negotiation that their own attorney had to leave the room. He got so upset watching it. And he was on their side, you know. So, he could be a bully. And he sort of, you know, fit their worst conceptions of, you know, of this guy from New York.
A New York Jew, let's say.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. My guest is Fred Goodman, and his latest book is Alan Klein, the man who bailed out the Beatles, made the Stones, and transformed rock and roll. He's such a complex character, and I want to kind of jump ahead to one of the stories later, which I think has left me perplexed. So George Harrison wrote a song called My Sweet Lord. It was a big hit, and it was clearly... has the same melody as He's So Fine, even the middle part. You know, I guess if it had just had one part, you could excuse it, but the middle part is the same also. So the...
By the way, I think the tune it was actually based on was probably Oh Happy Day.
Huh.
Because, you know, Billy Preston was a gospel artist, and he was involved in the original session where the song was written, you know, and probably had a hand in its evolution. And, you know, that was a tune that Preston played.
I guess that's a similar tune also.
And it is a similar, you know, structure.
So Edwin Hawkins could have sued, too.
Well, I don't know if Edwin... I mean, Edwin Hawkins had the hit. You know, I don't know who has the authorship.
Who actually wrote
it. Very well
thing.
Be a traditional thing, much like the Rolling Stones the last time.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So the people who owned the copyright were suing George, and so Alan Klein bought the publishing, right? So that...
Well, yeah, you're jumping a little ahead, because really the beauty of the story is that, you know, he is managing George Harrison when George Harrison is sued by the publisher of He's So Fine, claiming that My Sweet Lord, which is this enormous global hit, is a copyright infringement on it. And of course, as Harrison's manager, he says, oh, this is just baloney, we're going to defend this suit, it's just not true. You know, well, within a year or two, he's no longer representing Harrison, and the case goes forward eventually, and Harrison loses. And the case is done in two parts. The first is to find out if it's true, and the second is to determine damages. And when they get to the damage phase, they find out that Alan Klein has bought the company that publishes He's So Fine. So the person who starts out saying it's not true turns out to be the person who's in a position to win this case. eventually what happened, and by the way, George Harrison was going to be assessed over $2 million for this song.
Right.
So he stood to lose a lot of money, but it's fascinating because at the end of the day, Harrison and his attorneys went to the judge and they said, look, Alan Klein used to be George's manager. He's not his manager anymore. But he continues to get paid for deals he did, so therefore his fiduciary duty to this guy doesn't end with the contract. And the judge said, you're right. So what happened was he had to buy He's So Fine from Alan Klein for about $600,000, and Klein would administer it and My Sweet Lord for Harrison and pay Harrison, and that was the settlement. And it's such a bizarre thing because you can't think of any other instance where somebody lost a copyright suit and wound up owning the song that won. So, and by the way, this case also went on 20 years. You know, and you talk about how Alan was a complicated person. You know, if you asked Alan, why are you doing this, he would say, well, I'm going to show George, you know, that I can take care of him, and I'm just going to give it to him. And, you know, he didn't expect Harrison to go ballistic when he found out about it. But Harrison did, and whether or not Alan ever really planned to give it to him, which he may or may not have, he also told friends of his that he thought the song was worth a lot more money than was being offered, and that there was a good settlement for somebody who owned the song. So he could undertake things for many reasons at the same time.
So let's talk about Alan Klein's origins. He was not he wasn't a musician. How did he get into the music business?
Well, he was an accountant by training. He went to college, studied accounting, and his first job was working for a firm in New York that specialized in auditing music publishers. And he got a taste for the music business, and he saw that music publishers, by habit, underpaid songwriters, and he thought, well, you know, if the songwriters are getting the shaft, it must be even worse for performers. So he decided to go into his business for himself, one of the reasons being that He couldn't get up in the morning and hold a job. He didn't mind working crazy hours till 3 or 4 in the morning, but he just couldn't get to an office in time and, of course, couldn't hold a job because in accounting, you got to come in. So in any event, he wound up working for himself and started, you know, meeting artists and selling himself as someone who would go and audit music publishers and record companies and find money. You know, he would meet someone and he would basically say something like, you know, let me go in and do this, and whatever I find, we'll split 50-50, and it'll just be found money. And he did. You know, he was very successful. I spoke with the singer Lloyd Price, you know, who told me in the early 60s that Alan had found him about $60,000, which was, you know, a huge sum of money at
right,
the time.
Yeah.
You know, and they you know, stayed lifelong friends. I mean, sometimes he wasn't as successful. There's a very famously, you know, he met the singer Bobby Darin at a wedding. You know, and instead of saying hello, he just sticks his hand out and says, I can get you $100,000, you know, and this became part of his legend, you know, that he had done this. But as far as I can tell, he didn't find any money for Bobby Darin.
Mm.
You know, that was one of his rare failures. But he did go on to have very big success. And one of his biggest early ones was for the singer Sam Cooke, you know, who had heard about Klein from Lloyd Price. And he met him at a show in Philadelphia. And went in and, you know, worked, did an audit for his publishing, renegotiated his recording contract, and Sam Cooke was so happy, he said to him, well, you know, instead of just being an accountant, why don't you be my business manager? And Alan said, well, you know, I never managed anybody before. And, you know, Sam Cooke said, I was never a songwriter till I wrote a song. You should just do it. And that was really how Klein became a manager.
We're chatting with Fred Goodman. He's the author of Alan Klein, the man who bailed out the Beatles, made the Stones, and transformed rock and roll. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Well, your book isn't just about Alan Klein. I mean, he's the main character, but we
right.
also learn about Andrew Luke Oldham, and we learn about Mickey Most. And in your title, you say that, that in your subtitle, Fred Goodman, you say that Alan Klein transformed rock and roll, and not just in a financial sense. I mean, I guess by introducing or putting together Mickey Most and Donovan, he changed the course of the sound
well,
of music.
Well, he has a bit of a role. I mean, he liked to be involved. He, you know, the exception was the Rolling Stones. You know, he realized he had nothing to contribute to them musically, or he kind of stayed the hell out of their way. You know, but he was not behindhand in giving his advice to Sam Cooke. You know, he urged him to promote A Change Is Going to Come. He thought it was a very important record. He worked with Bobby Vinton, you know, and talked music a lot. Alan, you know, he's a music guy, cared about music. And with John Lennon as well, you know, he would critique John Lennon's music, if you could imagine that. But,
yeah.
You know, it's true. You know, when I met Donovan gave Alan a lot of credit, you know, and said that meeting Alan was one of the best things that happened to him. He had been managed by an associate of Brian Epstein's, and Klein got involved and became his manager and was going to, you know, renegotiate his contracts, get him more money, get him move him from a small record company in America to CBS, you know, that sort of thing. And Donovan was very close to the Beatles, and really envied the relationship they had with George Martin, who was both the Beatles producer and an arranger. You know, he could bring a lot to their recording sessions. And Donovan wanted to move further from folk music into something a little more pop and sophisticated. And he said, you know, gee, I wonder, you know, what I could do. And Alan said, well, you should meet Mickey Most, who was someone Alan had been representing, who already had produced most famously The Animals and Herman's Hermits. So those were sort of the big acts that he had, and he put Donovan with Mickey, who then introduced him to a young arranger who had just finished Cambridge, and the three of them, the first record they did was Sunshine Superman, which of course was both Donovan's breakthrough and sort of an early psychedelic pop record, a very important one, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, he turned out to be a pretty good marriage broker in that case. But, you know, that was sort of the exception. I mean, really what he's doing that's transforming rock and roll is he's getting contracts that give the artists more freedom. You know, Sam Cooke, the Rolling Stones, they get more financial freedom, you know, and more control over their music. You know, one of the things he does is, you know, he gets what are called reversion rights. And it begins with Sam Cooke, where he negotiates that at a certain at the end of a certain length of time, the record company has to return all the rights to Sam. And that is something that now is sort of very much a part of the business, but was unheard of at the time. And perhaps the most successful practitioners are the Rolling Stones,
who are now re-releasing all their stuff.
Well, every time they have a new contract, you know, the catalog, except for the part controlled by Alan Klein, moves with them, you know, and they get paid again on it.
Although they did, in your book, you talk about a greatest hits record they did several years ago, but then they just recently did another one that was even had more ABCO songs on it.
Yeah, I mean, look, they've this long-running acrimony, you know, it's still not, you know, love. You know, but they've been able to find that spot where they can get things done together and, you know, when they need to do it. And both sides recognize the sort of value that the other has for each other at this point.
So I guess my big question about Alan Klein, like you and I were saying earlier, we as Beatles fans, you know, we knew who Alan Klein was. And if you take Paul McCartney's side, he was a villain. And even John Lennon later told Paul McCartney that he was right about Klein.
Right.
So, you know, was Klein a good guy or a bad guy, and was he a criminal?
Well, he was no angel, first of all. I mean, you know, if you asked me, would I want Alan Klein managing my career, my answer to you would be, I'd much rather have him just advising me as a friend, you know, because he has a way, you know, back then particularly, you know, of getting himself into the deals, you know, and take he got deals no one else could. And in the entertainment business, you know, if you're a guy who can get deals that no one else can, you get paid like no one else. You know, and that's sort of the story then and the story now. Most fascinating to me, you know, I had a conversation with Irving Azoff, you know, who's managed the Eagles and run record companies and Ticketmaster and Live Nation.
Another
villain, depending on who you talk to. But I noticed the Eagles have been managed by him for 45 years. That's how much of a villain he must be, you know. So the upshot of it is, you know, I said to him, what did you think? He said, well, I really liked Alan. He said, you know, and I, you know, did he take too big a piece? I don't really know. He said, but back in those days, everybody took too big a piece. You know, he said, I don't think he was did anything that guys like Ahmet Erdogan didn't do. You know, and certainly Ahmet is a guy who, you know, ran into, you know, financial contretemps. You know, had the Rhythm and Blues Foundation and all those lawsuits over that stuff. But at the same time, was never vilified. You know, and never, you know, put under this thing. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, you got Paul McCartney and Mick Jagger mad at you, and they're the two most important rock stars in the world. So you got to pay for it on the other end. However, that said, you know, Alan, yes, Alan went to jail on a tax case. He spent 2 months in jail in New York when he was convicted on a misdemeanor resulting from selling promo records. And to my knowledge, I think the only guy ever convicted of selling promo records, which is kind of amazing because it was a very widespread practice. You know, so it's really kind of, you know, no angel. That's for certain. You know, when you're dealing with this guy, he isn't necessarily telling you everything you need to know. So, you know, he doesn't get, you know, an all clear, all thumbs up. But, you know, he's getting you more money than anybody else is.
And did he ever steal any money from his people? I mean, you say take a bigger piece, but...
Yeah, you know, here's what... I mean, you can tell me whether you think this is stealing. I think if you're Mick Jagger, you might think it's stealing, okay? you know, what happened was, back then, and this is particularly affects the English Act, the English tax laws were really draconian. If you made money in the United States in the 1960s as a recording artist, you might lose 90% of it in taxes. So if you're the Rolling Stones and you've been promised $1.5 million in America, you have to figure out a way to keep more than $150,000. Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to be very unhappy. And Klein did figure out ways. And what he would do was he would invest the money in the United States and pay it out over 20 years. And under those kinds of, you would take the income not as royalties but as investment on, you know, income on investments overseas, and it would be taxed at a more favorable rate, and over the long haul you would get to keep all your money. So what he's doing is investing this money and saying to the Stones, this way we'll pay it out, you'll keep it all, you'll get it over 20 years. But the fact of the matter is he's almost only promised to pay them $1.5 million, but he's investing $1.5 million for 20 years, which means he's going to make a good deal more than that.
And he's going to keep that part.
And he's going to keep that money because that's not what you've been promised. You've been promised your $1.5 million. So, you know, if you're Mick Jagger, and that's why I say well, I want him as my manager, you know, no, because it's like, well, you should have told me this, right? I mean, you're not duty-bound to tell me it, but, you know, you really should tell me this.
It's such a complex and fascinating story. I mean, he sees people that have millions of dollars coming in. He gets them more money and gets a great big piece for himself.
Gets a big piece. And plus, you know, he's also telling people early on, I mean, in his deal with Mickey Most, it's a similar thing. He says, look, I'll get you $1 million. And he does figure out a way to get Mickey Most contracts that are going to pay him $1 million. And even better, tells him, I won't even charge you. I'll get my fee in America managing your business. And what he does is he sets it up so that the record companies make him the manufacturer. So he's making his money as the manufacturer and basically taking it out of the record company's ends. And later on with the Stones, he does the same thing. They're not happy to see that, you know, Alan Klein is continuing to make money manufacturing their records.
Who all did you get to talk to as you were researching this?
Oh, book? It was really fun. I mean, Donovan, you know, the Stones do not like to talk about Alan Klein.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's not surprising for many reasons. You know, one of them being, you know, and it's not even a question of are they mad at him or anything like that. You know, the Stones just kind of like to tell their own story, and in the Stones story, there's no one but the Stones.
Right.
So, you know, that's sort of a natural thing. You know, I had some really fascinating conversations with John Eastman, who was Paul McCartney's brother-in-law and business manager, and handled the lawsuit that McCartney brought against the Beatles to remove Alan Klein as the manager. And that was really an eye-opener. And, you know, sort of the best persons for me, you know, on the Stones were Andrew Oldham, their manager, and also Marianne Faithfull, who aside from, you know, being managed by Klein, was Mick Jagger's girlfriend at the time. And she really had a very good perspective on it. You know, she said to me, look, you know, you might make the argument that it wasn't a good thing to give Alan Klein so much financial control. But, you know, it was so important to get broken in America. And Alan was key in that. You know, who's to say if they hadn't made this deal with Alan, the Rolling Stones wouldn't have been just another little English band.
Right, right. It's an amazing story. The book is called Alan Klein, the man who bailed out the Beatles, made the Stones, and transformed rock and roll. And the author, my new best friend, Fred Goodman. Fred Goodman, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Really a pleasure, Gary. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see me again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and I wish you would. And you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Fred Goodman. His latest book, Alan Klein, the man who bailed out the Beatles, made the Stones, and transformed rock and roll. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.